Welcome back, folks, to our Stanford AI Healthcare Podcast. We're super excited to be joined by Dr. Saeed Mohideen, who is a close friend, physician by training, formerly at McKinsey, running a lot of AI efforts at Health and Human Services, and is now the Chief AI Transformation and Strategy Officer at UnitedHealth Group. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here and great to see you and Matt.
How many of those queries that used to go out to your own personal consults to friends no longer go out to those friends? Like, how much of a reduction based on using the AI systems are you feeling now? And then again, just, from a personal capacity.
To me, it's like when, as an internal medicine doc, you are a quarterback to care. So you're constantly in this dynamic with other people to keep getting better and better information and refine your hypothesis, right? I'd say, again, this is not practicing, this is just in my personal life, matters impacting my daughter, my family, my friends, or myself. I'd say overall volume is up 5 to 10x. And I'd say, because a lot of the lower hanging stuff now I can get answers to versus just they linger in the back of your mind. Overall volume, I'd say, is up 5 to 10x. And I'd say my outreach to specialists is 50% less. So you could say it's a 10 to 20x productivity gain.
I mean, that's much better quantization. I think on my side, it's probably in that ballpark. I would say that I still, if it's super important, right? Like, I like to just show up like I've done some homework, I guess, in that way. And so, like, I'll do some of the cognitive work on my side that I wouldn't have done otherwise. 'Cause I'm, am I, would I've really kind of really gone down a rabbit hole in the literature? Yeah, maybe if it's super important, but now, like, okay, I'm gonna have this thing do a shotgun pass, and maybe I'll do some follow-ups. And then I bring that to a colleague. But you're totally right. Like, for the quick, hey, FYI, I've got a neighbor that, mentioned this, and just I said this, just want to double check I'm right, that kind of thing. Not often anymore. And
Not
frankly,
off exactly. It's th
but the
there's,
inbound is lower too, right? Don't you feel like
yeah,
they're
you get less.
using the
Yeah.
models
Because
too, right?
I used to have friends and family reach out to me all the time for questions that they don't reach out to me anymore, which is great. But now, if you do get incoming, you take it like, all right, I'm going to create space for this. And like, this feels like borderline inappropriate, but I'm going to name drop here at the risk of politics. Like, what still happens is I had a friend reach out to me with an urgent geographic, like a local, it was in the mid-Atlantic slash Northeast, medical need, needing to get a specialist for a certain kind of cancer. And AI is not going to nail the answer who's the exact right doctor at Hopkins or MSK or whatever for this very rare and unique thing. There, I picked up the phone and called who we all know I know and said, all right, this was back when she was running NCI and said, all right, here's the situation. What do I got to do? There's no substitute for that yet.
No, it's fascinating because this trend, again, we all feel it, again, not in the professional sense, but in a personal sense for how we're managing care. And I think the interesting thing is we're starting to see more and more data come out supporting this. So, this was a Bain survey. Looks like it was 500 people in March 2024 to September 2025. And there's a few different pieces, but I'll jump to the bottom, which to
Justin,
me is
I
the
love
most
how you bring the
fascinating.
ex-McKinsey guy in and first slide, here's a Bain survey. Thanks, man.
Yeah,
I
I
love you
just had
back.
to, I
I
had
love you
to, I
back.
had to drill in, had to drill in. But this last one's fascinating. When there's a
Yeah.
McKinsey one to show, I'll show that next. AI becomes my doctor. Percentage of consumers comfortable with AI. And we don't know the exact question or exactly how they did it, but 11% in 2024 to 2025, almost 30% now. That's fascinating. And as we talk about all the other impacts, and we'll get to value-based care and health systems and payers and all that soon, this one trend, again, we all feel, as we just talked about in our personal lives, patients are starting to choose this too. Like, what happens to this system? What happens to the system? And extrapolate one more year, maybe this number's 50%. That is just so such a fast pace of change to a healthcare system that normally moves extremely slow. And Saeed, you've seen this also, at the government side as well. How are you kind of putting these kind of trends into kind of how you run your job and what you think is coming for healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is like, look, jokes aside, it's obviously a powerful number. You're talking about a 2.5x increase in 1 year, right? 1 year. And I think just to break it down a bit, this is a combination of headwinds and tailwinds, where you have headwinds, people are increasingly frustrated with the care they get. Because there is a supply issue, there is a physician shortage, there is a clinician shortage, and the amount of time you have in your patient visits, the amount of time, the sort of availability or access issues in terms of time from when you want to schedule an appointment to when you actually schedule an appointment, also the personalization. Back in the day, you knew your doctor. Now, increasingly, people don't know their doctor, so then the substitutability goes up. Right now, that's the headwind. The tailwind is okay, substitutability goes up, convenience issues, delays. Why don't I start doing what Matt and Justin and Syed are doing, what everyone else is doing? And you guys, I know the three of us know the internal numbers that OpenAI and others have probably shared with us around the number of millions upon millions of users who are going to them and submitting clinical queries, by the way, physicians and non-physicians alike. Submitting clinical queries, and that's true of all these AI applications. So increasingly, the idea that the information can come from a non-human has gone up. Now, the important question is the question you asked, Justin. What then does that mean, and what does that look like? So I've heard this existential, oh my God, doctors are going to be gone, blah, blah, blah. Like, calm down. What this is saying is for that massive volume of care that isn't being done, can we introduce a layer where care is actually done? Can we manage care more effectively? Can we do preventive care? Can we actually do prevention? Can we actually answer people's questions when they have them, not 6 and 10 and 12 weeks later, right? So all of this stuff that is not just the 15 minutes of the actual patient visit, but the 364 and a half days you spend outside of the clinic. That's what we're able to get at by everyone is imagine a world where everyone has their own LLM, individualized LLM, their own a chatbot that knows them, that knows everything about them, all the data, everything that's helping them with their care. Guess what? Increasingly, that becomes the quarterback of your care. So I, Syed Muhammad Muhyiddin, licensed internal medicine physician, trained to be a quarterback of care. Now I have an agent who is my sidekick. Who's helping me do two things? One, actually expand my panel size because that's what the population needs. And then, and by the way, expand by managing and doing the care management, doing a lot of the administrative stuff, taking care of the lower risk questions around the health. But then, two, allows me to come in and do the reason I fell in love with medicine, take on harder cases and figure out, just like I had to consult, the former head of the National Cancer Institute, who in my friend network and who in my referral network. Right? In my appropriately tiered referral network, do I need to pull in to ensure that this person gets the best possible care at the highest value? Right? So you're actually getting into a world with AI where you can take care of people end to end the whole time, not just a couple of days you see them, and achieve value in a way that we've not really seen in the 15 years, roughly 15 years since we, launched CMMI and started really pushing for value-based care. It's a long answer, but those are my two cents. Matt, what do you think?
Well, no, I was just, nodding my head. I think your answer is incredibly well articulated. It does bring up an interesting point that there is this, it's like the classic iceberg, right? We're all thinking about the tip, right? All the time about the work that we're doing in our day-to-day lives and in the practice of medicine today, kind of knowing it's there, but not feeling overwhelmed that even just trying to address that under the surface mass of unmet needs, access, the quality of the care. And frankly, to your point, the time between the visits, where we have been saying forever, man, if we could just get our, patients to, jump in and just be more proactive about, I think that there's a willingness to do that, but the tools, I just don't think were there. The information asymmetry, as we've talked about on this show, has been a barrier. Are we now in a place where that starts to, again, we've Is there a true partnership that starts to form? And to your point, the quarterbacking, I think the other version of this that we see in the And so the coding community is like you're kind of elevating into another meta level of orchestration of different capable, whether they're agents or other services. And now that's a higher cognitive plane, I think, for and maybe even a more satisfactory one as a practitioner to say, I'm really elevating working at the top of my license and orchestrating things at a scale that I never could before. But also makes me feel as though I'm truly partnering with my patients and their journey through the health system. So
Matt,
I remain optimistic, but everyone knows I'm a glass, three quarters full guy on a lot of this stuff. And there will be detractors from some of this, I'm sure. But on the road there, it feels like it's a push-pull to your point about the headwinds and tailwinds.
the amazing thing is in a traditional world where you don't have AI agents and you don't have this level of orchestration, you unfortunately end up doing what folks often refer to as sick care, because that's what you can bill for, right? In this future world, if you do have AI agents able to engage individuals on so many things beyond just the quote-unquote sick care, I'm getting nutrition counseling. Okay, yes, I have diabetes, but I have, at my fingertips, help navigating what I put in my body that is, responsive to my metabolic demands and my individualized metabolic state, right? I'm able to go far beyond in my activities, beyond like my doctor just saying, hey, the American Heart Association says work out X number of minutes, Y times per week, based on your risk factors. Now, okay, I like biking, or I hate biking. I like swimming. Like, I can get individualized plans, and I can get someone to help me manage my life in a way that, man, life is hard for most people. And it's hard to do all of this on your own to get a little bit of help, not just for people who can afford all the coaches and the trainers and all that, but just in the form of smart, board certified help at my fingertips. That's pretty great.
So I'm curious, like Syed, you painted this amazing future vision. You said a few things, amazing future vision about what's possible. Let's move from sick care, proactive care, health, all these things. Typically, when those things come up, policy is, the next question. Well, the incentives aren't there. We don't have the right system to pay for that, which you brought up and all these things. My question is, do we think we need policy changes to start seeing some of the benefits from these tools that you talked about? Can we leave the status quo the same from a policy perspective? And are there enough right circles where the incentives are lined up where you think this adoption will happen naturally?
That's a good question. I will say this. You can always accelerate priorities and manage risk through policy. I think the position we took in the last administration and the position this administration is continuing to take, building on kind of what we did, is there's still so much we have to learn so that we don't over-regulate this space, right? Because that is a risk. We want to make sure that we're spurring innovation. At the same time, we want to make sure that we're continuing to learn and we're actually talking to each other. What the administration, where they've really built on what we started doing with, things like our voluntary AI commitments and whatnot, is they've really tried to say, you know what, let's align on a few priorities, create a coalition of the willing, and the CMS pledges, for instance, and try to drive adoption in responsible ways by bringing people together and having them talk to each other. That can only be a start, and we're not going to go where we need to go. You're not going to have AI-driven primary care without meaningful FDA involvement. So the way it needs to happen, the FDA doesn't know how to do this. They still don't have mechanisms in place for, post-appointment surveillance and monitoring, for instance, which is obviously essential for Gen AI-based applications, especially that, say you have something in a pacemaker or something like that, something that's in your body. So in that world, they know, just as we did, that there are mechanisms not yet established to fully vet how you're going to do this. I think this notion of experimental sandboxes, where you have data sharing and partnership between government and these entities, and you sort of work together on the right regulatory mechanisms, is the right way to go. How exactly that plays out and what exactly the policies are, there's lots of debates being had on that. And, I left that game over a year ago, so it's not my problem anymore.
Well, separate one more, separate from
kidding,
the
I kidding.
policy side.
It's all of
I
our
know.
problems. But anyways, sorry, go ahead.
No, but separate from the policy side, like let's say there aren't more changes. So there's, it's more or less status quo. Yes, there's lots of good things going on to learn, share data, but nothing sweeping. You can't wave your wand and say, hey, single payer, anything like that. Is there enough incentive today anyway to see these things start to move? And then I'll give
So,
my like
yeah, I want to
I think
hear.
the answer is I think the answer is I think the answer is yes. As you look at previously when you talked about digital therapeutics or other areas, you really needed a push and a payment mechanism because there wasn't that natural pull. There wasn't a natural pull, and I'll share a little bit more data that we can look at. Now what's happening, there is a pull. There is a pull towards these AI tools because people believe, health systems believe that there's a real value in ROI separate from any new payment mechanism, carrots or sticks that may come down the road. And so, again, where I'm less certain is how far does that take us? Does that take us to kind of the, medical utopia you talked about, or kind of do we get somewhere separate? And so just to talk through a little bit of the data we're looking at here, there was a recent report by Menlo Ventures that talked about the state of healthcare AI, both funding and where adoption is happening by buyers. And there's a few interesting things they called out, which I'm not sure all of us agree with from what we're seeing on the day-to-day, but a ton of scribe adoption, a ton of coding and billing adoption, mostly by health systems, and a lot more than what they found on the payer side of this. And so one thing that's interesting versus before is we're seeing technology adoption without kind of any policy changes happening naturally. And so the question is, how far does that take us? And then also, want to get this understanding of, do we think these numbers are right? Does this payer versus provider spend kind of match, what we're seeing in the real world?
All fair questions. Two or three kind of quick reactions to the page, and just this idea. What's clear is folks on the payer and provider side, I'd say led by payers, but we're seeing increasing activity, especially in the RCM space among providers, are really focused on administrative areas of opportunity, right? So that could be SG&A opportunities or OpEx opportunities. You see some on operations there on the right, but I think that's more universal than just that little $50 million narrow sliver. But then you also see revenue opportunities. So think coding optimization as a good example, right? So that I think in a world that relies on administrative efficiency or where administrative efficiency is the priority and you're not directly impacting patients, i.e., you're kind of free from a regulatory standpoint or more free from a regulatory standpoint, as you get AI agents doing, replacing the task of humans and able to coordinate with one another to execute more and more complex tasks, I think we're frankly at the tip of the iceberg of where that administrative efficiency space can go without any additional regulation. I think on the clinical side, and by the way, even your ambient number, that ties to a lot of administrative applications, as you know, in terms of how you can get revenue and what you can enable, what really actually even beyond just kind of coding optimization you can enable by having ambient scribes, including care management, including a whole bunch of other stuff that benefited from a higher fidelity, higher integrity document, clinical documentation. So that is the administrative side. On the clinical side, that's where, even engagement is not necessarily directly a clinical play. That's like, do you have coverage of benefits clear? Are you showing up to your appointment, et cetera? But the real clinical side, I think that's revenue models that will actually serve people effectively, that will have the right incentives to do the right thing, and then it makes systems better at delivering care. That I think is where it's going to, at a minimum, you're going to need some guidance from the federal government in terms of how far you can lean in, because you start touching humans and patients. That's where I think the rubber meets the road and regulation will be required. What do you guys think?
I mean, my comment on this slide. I agree with your points, and I think directionally this makes sense. I think to look at it by spend and buyer. But I think there's something else there too, which is, as we increasingly hear from, again, those that are leading in this space in various ways, the rapid, reduction in costs, or the quote unquote, asymptotically heading to free intelligence kind of vision. Like, I do think that this is going to be a poor way to track the outcomes or the impact of AI in a variety of areas. In particular, you brought up the administrative side, which at some level, a lot of those tasks we all know, which occupy a lot of humans' time today, are probably achievable with where the technology is now without requiring a great deal of spend. And we've, at least I believe that will increasingly be the case. And so, like, I guess if you look at some of these spending charts, what would you predict that, how would you predict they would change over time? My guess would be that the ambient spend, so to speak, would go down, right? And the spend is going to shift towards, in my view, things that are much more challenging for the technology. In other words, some difficult precision medicine efforts, some clinical trial based matching, some other more sophisticated aspects. And a lot of the spend is going to kind of, I think, I don't want to call it totally deflationary because there are services and things, but at some level, I just don't know how this will ultimately be the best way we track the impact of AI in healthcare.
Yeah, it's not. You're totally right. There's like entire categories missing from this. No offense to Menlo Ventures, and I think it's good in terms of saying, hey, what are some of the main use cases and directionally where are players putting their resources? But even if you go back to the page before, I mean, to not have green for payers in some of these buckets, even if you were to confine yourself to these kind of core six use cases, is an intellectual miss. And then if you go to the next slide and you say, okay, where's the puck going? I couldn't agree more with Matt in terms of categories that are just not represented, right? Like, I think clinical AI is going to be massive in 3 to 5 years. I think, and it's not just what you're seeing today, even from like some of the EHR vendors and some of the others, is, how do we improve provider productivity? Ambient doesn't really do that. It might do that a little bit, a few percent, but the in-basket management and some of the, simplifying back office operations and stuff like that, which is different than payer operations, I think that's going to be tons of activity and investment in those spaces. But then the whole space of clinical innovation is fundamentally missing here. And that's what increasingly becomes possible when you have more data, better data, and you're able to connect these sources and have folks working on each individual case, to Matt's precision medicine point, in a scalable way.
Yeah, and it's clear and good in all the conversations we have, is it is right to start on the administrative side first. How that
Yes.
spending happens and what comes with clinical AI is going to change what medicine looks and feels like. And just to show one more piece of data, this was a
But
last
Justin,
chart.
even before you do that, sorry, like even the spend in administrative is going to collapse in interesting ways, right? Like payment integrity, revenue cycle management, prior authorization, as these systems are increasingly able to talk to each other and you've got APIs connecting everything, you've got high fidelity on your data, and because in part enabled by ambient, you're connecting, you have better interoperability, you have more longitudinal data, you have deeper data. Like, now you can do transactions in real time. Now you have transparency in a way you've never had transparency before, right? That's an entire different category of, it's not just spend going up, but in some ways you're shrinking value pools. In other ways, you're creating new value pools that we also need to think about. So it's fine to take snapshots, and those are snapshots that I would argue aren't entirely accurate. But what really is the interesting work is, what does tomorrow look like?
Right. And so you are squarely, because it's come up on a number of panels I've been on, people talking about right now, there's this, AI arms race. You have, UHG talking about 1,000 AI systems providers, at least in Menlo's report, talking about more spend on AI coding, $1 billion. So there's the worry, and I've even talked with some on the administration of, do these AI fighting AI just increase net healthcare costs? But it sounds like you're very much on the opposite side of, maybe that's a short-term blip piece, but where we're going is no way.
The honest truth is, different players in the ecosystem structurally have different incentives on what happens to healthcare costs, right? And I'm not going to go and name them. You can look at trend analyses and make those conclusions for yourself. Where I sit, right? And this is not intended to be an infomercial for UnitedHealth Group, but where I sit is actually, I feel privileged, and frankly, the reason I came to this company, it felt almost like an extension of being in the government. It was the goals were identical, which was how do you serve the maximum amount of this United States health population to the best of your ability, achieve the health goals, health outcomes that you want to achieve while controlling price. Right? If you think about the function of a payer, or in the case of Optum Health, fully delegated model, or in the case of Optum Insight, in terms of what they're bringing to the industry, it's all centered around doing it in a way that brings price down. That is, I will comment on us. Our incentives are to bring price down while maximizing the footprint and depth of impact on care delivery, right? No matter where you sit in the organization, philosophically, that is our focus. I think there are countervailing forces in the industry that want to see it go to the other side. Who wins will be a multifactorial play. And what that looks like a few years from now, also the collaboration model between payers and providers will be a multifactorial play. At some point, it can't just be about punching each other in the face and seeing who blinks last or blinks first, whatever the analogy is. At some point, it's got to be sitting together and saying, hey, let's bring data together. Let's be transparent about what rules engines we're applying, and make sure that based on that transparent understanding of what's there and what's possible and what we're trying to do, that we execute a plan together, right? And then that shall start showing up in contracts and so on and so forth. And we're ways away from there. I think there's probably going to be, in a way, increasing tension between payers and providers before it gets to the other side. And regulators are going to have to decide if, where, and how they want to step in. I won't step on their toes. I've lost that baton. We'll see how it plays out. But I am very committed for the role of UnitedHealth Group and my role in it to be a deflationary force.
Yeah, and I think as you're talking about this, and again, I feel the same way in terms of like there's always been this kind of yin and yang, fox and rabbit kind of moments that just based on the way the incentives are structured. But I guess like I wonder if there's like a third or maybe even a fourth trend that we started with that also starts to play a role here. And I'm thinking about again the patient who. Let's be honest, we definitely think of them. We all of our mission statements talk about them in all of our different organizations, but ultimately the true empowerment really wasn't there until I think recently. Now I'm starting to see this kind of new empowered patient voice leveraging this technology. And I wonder how that starts to play a role in some of these traditional incentives. And frankly, even to the point where I would also throw physicians in who, yes, we've had a voice in various ways, but not maybe at the level that really impacted some of these broader tensions in the market. And more physicians than ever are choosing to work at places that have things like ambient scrub. Like the technology is kind of actually helping physicians make decisions and potentially even strike out on their own, for example, more than I've seen before. I don't know if there's a way to put a finger on the pulse of this trend at this point, but I guess it seems like it's another player on the field that before now hasn't really impacted the game.
Here's your hot take for the day, because I know we're nearing the end. This industry is going to look drastically different in 5 years. Drastically. The role of the incumbent, obviously, as a member of an incumbent, as an employee of an incumbent, the role of the incumbent is for the incumbent to decide. But if the incumbent keeps just doing what they've historically done, they will have a significantly diminished role for one reason. The most important people in this entire ecosystem are patients, the citizens of the United States, and increasingly it'll be citizens of the world as all these systems get more connected. But the citizens, scope it to the 330 million here, they will make that decision and they will have the options to make that decision. So if we're going to be in service of them, then we got to step into the lead in disrupting the industry. First disrupt ourselves, then ultimately disrupt the industry. That's a choice for all of us to make. And it's hard because then you're saying no to legacy business models and legacy practices. But you're saying yes to the future, and you're saying yes to your the most important people in the ecosystem, your patients, your members.
I totally love that, and I couldn't agree more. I think what's fascinating right now is everyone who has said for their careers in healthcare will look so different in 5 years. Everyone who has made that statement or that hot take that you mentioned has been wrong in pretty big ways, for the past decades. I completely agree with you, but I mentioned that because the historical context for most leaders now, whether it's a big health system, payer, government organization across the country, it has been the wrong answer to lean into the new technology. They got to that point in their career because they didn't jump too early at AI in a different iteration. They didn't jump too early, but it is coming. And I agree with that force of the consumer who will force this upon the industry. And with where we started, that 3x almost increase now in AI, I feel comfortable with as my doctor, that is what's going to drive change.
Let's just be, a couple factors, right? When you had high tech and meaningful use in the decades prior, basically spanning over the last couple of decades, that was a multi-billion dollar central investment to drive a change in an industry that ultimately made physicians less satisfied and patients less satisfied. Now you get a printout of a discharge summary and you have no idea what the hell it says. Excuse me, what it says. Now, forward-looking, you have a technology that you just showed the stat, the 11 to 28%, where patients are increasingly using it and increasingly getting comfortable. Doctors, look at the trend in Ambien. Doctors are using it. They are demanding, to Matt's point, if you don't have this, then I'm not going to practice here, right? So at the end of the day, if you want to transform an industry, and that's an overused term, but if you really do want to transform anything, you have to show the end user how what you're offering them is meaningfully better. You can't just throw money at them. You can't just dangle rules at them. You have to show them how it's meaningfully better. If you do that, change will happen super fast. And I do believe, especially with what's coming, we've only talked about what's been, but what's coming with the ability to execute intelligent, highly intelligent tasks in a coordinated and orchestrated way. If in essentially being a boots on the ground workforce that is not human, I think that's going to materially change what we can do, how it's done, and potentially TBD who does it. I don't think I'm going to be wrong. We'll
No,
see, Justin.
you're putting your bet on the same space we are. I mean, and again, this goes back again to the beginning where I just feel it. It's I know they always say this. It feels different this time, and the reason I say that is that it's coming from the bottoms up, and not the top down. And I just feel like that is the way that we've seen the true change happen in sort of legacy industries or businesses, et cetera. And so I'm here for it, and this is why we do this show, because we get to keep tabs on what's happening.
So are all the major institutional investors in this country. So fingers crossed, bigger issues if we can't crack this.
On that happy note, Sam, thank you so much for joining us,
Great to
and
see you
we'll talk
guys.
soon.
Let's make this change happen responsibly. It's going to be awesome for humans, for patients. And that is, I know what the three of us live for. It is why we're friends, other than hopefully having decent personalities and the like. See you guys.
Thank you.